It is Monday, July the 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, President Obama continues historic visits to Ethiopia and Kenya.
Kenya's on the move. Africa is on the move. You are poised to play a bigger role in this world as the shadows of the past are replaced by the light that you offer.
Also ahead, Turkey strikes Islamic State in Syria and the PKK in Iraq. Plus, it's been 50 years since Dylan shocked the jazz world at Newport. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Obama's first state visit to Ethiopia is being met with both excitement and caution as intense security is evident all about the capital, Addis Ababa. VOA's Anita Powell has the story.
This attention to security has made Ethiopia a close ally of the United States in fighting terrorism in East Africa. While Somalia's Al-Shabaab extremist group has struck in neighboring Kenya and as far as Uganda, Ethiopia has kept the extremists from reaching over its border. Earlier this month, witnesses in Somalia said 3,000 Ethiopian troops entered Somalia, reportedly to target the extremist group. Some critics of the government, among them about a dozen imprisoned journalists and bloggers, say this security often comes at the expense of their civil liberties and human rights. The U.S. State Department lists several concerns in its human rights report on Ethiopia, from restrictions on freedom of expression and freedom of association to harassment and intimidation of opposition members and journalists, and even alleged arbitrary killings, alleged torture, beating, abuse, and mistreatment of detainees by security forces. Many residents of Addis Ababa, when approached by VOA, said they had no opinion on Mr. Obama's visit. Some say they are disappointed in Mr. Obama, a common refrain in Africa where many say they expected more from the first American president of African origin. But others say they are hopeful about his visit. Information technology manager Samson Kiflum said more cooperation with the American IT industry would be nice. But his biggest wish?
Maybe better freedom. Not technology, actually better freedom. Yeah.
Bank employee Malaku Alameru echoed many people concerned Mr. Obama's carefully choreographed trip would shield him from the often harsh realities of life for many Ethiopians.
The president shall see whether the development of Ethiopia is real or not, or whether the government is true or the opposite is true. The government is saying that human rights are respected, and the oppositors are saying that not respected. Rather, the government is denying the human rights of Ethiopia.
After speaking to Malaku, VOA was ordered by Addis Ababa police to stop filming and immediately leave the area. Anita Powell, VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
President Obama went to Ethiopia late Sunday after spending several days in Kenya, his ancestral homeland. It was the first time a sitting U.S. president had visited Kenya. Mr. Obama was last there before he was president when he was a member of the U.S. Senate. On Sunday, Mr. Obama spoke to the Kenyans at a Nairobi sports arena. He encouraged them to remain diligent in their efforts to grow their country and go beyond the times when corruption and mistreatment of women, he said, and young people was the norm.
You can't be complacent and accept the world just as it is. You have to imagine what the world might be and then push and work towards that future. Progress requires that you honestly confront the dark corners of our own past, extend rights and opportunities to more of your citizens, see the differences and diversity of this country as a strength, just as we in America try to see the diversity of our country as a strength and not a weakness.
And he went on to say that Kenya is a country making great progress.
I want to say, particularly to the young people here today, Kenya's on the move. Africa is on the move. You are poised to play a bigger role in this world as the shadows of the past are replaced by the light that you offer an increasingly interconnected world. And in the light of this new day, we have to learn to see ourselves and one another. We have to see that we are connected. Our fates are bound together.
And while in Nairobi, Mr. Obama co-hosted the Global Entrepreneurship Summit with Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. President Obama reiterated U.S. support for Kenyans as they embrace entrepreneurship and move forward as a major player, he said, on the world economic scene. At the summit, Mr. Kenyatta had this message for the entrepreneurs who had come from around the world.
When you go home, and indeed as you travel around the world, tell those who you meet about what you've seen here in Kenya. Share your experiences and let them know that Africa is open and ready for business.
When Mr. Kenyatta and President Obama opened the summit, they announced new commitments to promote entrepreneurship as a driver of economic growth, as well as social inclusion and to secure communities. And as you might imagine, the world of social media was abuzz about President Obama's visit to the country where his father was born and where still many of his family members live. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here to tell us all about the buzz. Hey, G.
Hi, Steve. Let's take a look at President Obama's Twitter handle, at POTUS. That's at POTUS. Mr. Obama tweeted Friday that he's proud to be the first American president to visit Kenya. He added, "Happy to see family and to talk with young Kenyans about the future." That's been retweeted nearly 18,000 times and marked as a favorite almost 29,000 times.
And how about Mr. Obama's counterpart, Uhuru Kenyatta?
Mr. Kenyatta has been quite prolific on Twitter. His first tweet about Obama's visit was on Friday when he tweeted, "Welcome to Kenya at POTUS." That simple tweet has been shared more than 1,300 times. Kenyatta is on Twitter at UKenyatta. He retweeted Mr. Obama's tweet that I just mentioned and shared photos of his arrival, participation at the Global Entrepreneurship Summit, or GES, bilateral talks, state dinner, and his departure to Ethiopia.
Gee, what were the hashtags used for this visit?
Well, to answer that question, let's turn to the social media analytics website Topsy. Hashtag Obama in Kenya was used more than 30,000 times during the last 24 hours. In the same time frame, hashtag GES2015 and hashtag GES2015Kenya were used around 3,000 times and 16,000 times, respectively.
I see. So hashtag Obama in Kenya was used more than the other two hashtags about the event combined.
Exactly. And hashtag Obama in Ethiopia was used more than 5,300 times in the last 24 hours. And before I go, I want to turn your attention to the most shared dance video on Twitter Sunday. It's a clip of President Obama dancing with his half-sister and a Kenyan pop group. The original clip first appeared on the group Sauti Sol's Instagram and later shared on Twitter by Washington-based journalist Femi Okey with Al Jazeera. That's all for me today. Steve?
Yeah, many thanks to you, G. That is some video. You should check it out. That is G. Abby Lee. And you know what? If you'd like to follow G on Twitter, her handle is at G. Abby Lee. You can also follow VOA's International Edition on Twitter. Our handle is at VOA_IE. Still ahead on the program, we have more news from Africa, so we hope you'll stay with us. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
This is VOA's International Edition. Also in the news, the White House is condemned as abhorrent Sunday's car bombing outside a hotel in the Somali capital, Mogadishu, that killed at least 9, wounded about 20 others. That attack heavily damaged the Jazeera Hotel, considered among the most secure in the city and home to several diplomatic missions. Attack was claimed by the Al-Shabaab militant group. The same hotel was targeted by militants back in 2012 while President Hassan Sheikh Mohammed was inside. It occurred as Somali forces backed by African Union troops launched an operation to push Al-Shabaab out of the last strongholds. Female suicide bombers detonated explosives in Marua in northern Cameroon and Damaturu, Nigeria, killing at least 35, wounding dozens of others. The target in Marua late Saturday was a bar where a young bomber set off her explosives. Last Wednesday, at least 20 people died in a marketplace in the regional capital following suicide bomb blast involving two teenage girls. In Damaturu, the capital of Yobe State, police spokesperson Toyin Bagadesan says a young girl with explosives managed to get past a security screening at the entrance to the marketplace.
At about 9:30 this morning, a female suicide bomber, a girl of about 10 years old, came to a popular market called Sunday Market in Damaturu. She capitalized on the advantage of the crowded gated entrance where screening was being conducted before people entered the market and detonated her device, killing herself and 14 other people.
And just a week ago, three policemen and five militants were killed by a car suicide bombing at a checkpoint on the outskirts of the capital. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but troops from Chad, Cameroon, Nigeria, and Niger formed a joint task force to push the insurgent group Boko Haram out of its strongholds in northern Nigeria. Pharmaceutical company GlaxoSmithKline has developed a new drug to fight malaria, which is prevalent in many countries around the world, including those in sub-Saharan Africa. International Edition's Jeffrey Young spoke with the company's head of vaccines.
Dr. Monsif Flawi stressed the importance of developing this malaria vaccine, Mosquirix, which, if fully approved for use, would be the first one to address this deadly disease. Dr. Flawi, could this be the breakthrough that turns the tide against this disease?
This is a very, very important day. Malaria kills about 500,000 children every year in sub-Saharan Africa. That makes it one child every minute. This vaccine has the potential to prevent about a third to a half of these deaths every year. It's going to be transformational for people living in sub-Saharan Africa, the parents of these children and the children themselves, of course.
What is malaria? What spreads the disease, and why are children so vulnerable?
Malaria is caused by a parasite. This parasite is transmitted through mosquito bites. A particular mosquito very specific to Africa carries this particular parasite. The parasites infect everybody is bitten by the mosquito, whether they're adults or children. Children are particularly susceptible because they have a developing immune system to help protect them against the parasites. As they become older, they get sick, but with less severity and less death.
People from areas where malaria is not prevalent, where it's not common, are highly susceptible to it. So there must be a certain level of built-up immunity in some areas. Is that true?
That's exactly what happens. A way to say it is, if you are lucky and you survive the early episodes of malaria that you get when you are an infant, then over time, every time you're bitten, you get sick, but you develop some level of immunity against the parasite. By the time you're an adolescent or an adult, if you have survived to that stage, you are mildly sick.
The World Health Organization also said that in 2013, malaria killed an estimated 584,000 people, but it also said that mortality rates among African children have declined by 58% since the year 2000. Tell me what was done to accomplish this significant reduction.
One of the most important interventions against malaria over the past 10, 15 years has been the introduction of bed nets that help protect the children from mosquitoes and therefore decrease the rate of transmission of malaria. We believe that the vaccine that we have approved today will be an addition to these bed nets and should hopefully decrease the rate of malaria by an equivalent amount.
Dr. Monsif Flawi is the chairman of vaccines at drug maker GlaxoSmithKline, discussing the company's new anti-malaria vaccine, Mosquirix.
That is International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Spurred by last week's jihadist suicide bombing in southern Turkey, the government of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has started to assume the kind of frontline role Washington has been urging for months. But Turkish airstrikes since the bombing have been as focused on Turkey's outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, as the Islamic State militants. And now Mr. Erdogan's government is calling for a meeting with NATO to discuss the country's security. For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks via Skype with Stephen Zunis, an international relations scholar specializing in the Middle East and a professor at the University of San Francisco.
Turkey is the only NATO country that borders Syria and Iraq. Obviously, they are directly impacted, not just by the humanitarian crisis, but with recent terrorist attacks committed to the Islamic State and related concerns. While attacking ISIS is one that presumably has a fair amount of support among NATO members, the attacks against the Kurds are another matter. Though the United States and at least some of the NATO allies recognize the PKK, the Kurdish Workers Party, which is engaged in a guerrilla war on and off for decades against the Turkish state, these are much more controversial because the PKK and their close allies, the Syrian-based PYD, have been among the most effective fighters against ISIS. And so we have a situation where you have U.S. Armed Turks bombing Kurdish forces, which have allied with the U.S. in attacks against ISIS. And it is yet another complication in this this terrible mess developing in that part of the world.
Well, is this really a cover, using IS as a cover to attack the Kurds, with which, of course, Turkey's had a long-running battle?
Well, certainly Turkey has its own reasons for wanting to move militarily against ISIS. At the same time, this very question has been raised, especially with the prospects of elections, early elections coming up, given the failure of Erdogan to form a new government. The reason he was unable to form a new government, the reason that his Islamist-based party was not able to get a majority, was the emergence of the People's Democratic Party, a left-leaning coalition that has largely come out of the Kurdish community. In other words, what this may be an effort to do is to divide Turkish sentiment, try to get the more moderate Kurds that are willing to work within the system, get them associated with the extremist Kurds, the PKK, and could be a part of the domestic politics as well. So a lot of people are reading different things into this, but it's certainly disturbing that in the midst of all the violence and internecine warfare taking part in this part of the world, that we now apparently have a renewal of the war between Turkey and the PKK.
In addition to Turkish airstrikes, Turkey is also opening its air bases to the U.S.-led coalition fighting IS. The Pentagon has called this a game changer. How important is it?
A game changer might be something of an exaggeration. This is at most a minor tactical advantage, but I don't see it as affecting the broader strategic equation.
Does Turkey's involvement against IS and against the Kurds complicate matters in the fight against the Islamic State?
Well, certainly the attack against the Kurds could make things worse, given that the Kurds have been so effective in the ground operations against the Islamic State. I mean, you can have Turkey, the United States, the Jordanians, the Iraqis, and others bombing various IS targets, but unless you have troops on the ground that are willing to engage them there, it's not going to make a huge difference. We've seen how both the Iraqi government and the Syrian government have not been particularly effective in engaging IS. It's been largely the Kurds who've been the ones who've done the bulk of the fighting. So if they're getting bombed too, it's the fight against ISIS is going to actually become more difficult.
That's Stephen Zunis, international relations scholar specializing in the Middle East. He's also a professor at the University of San Francisco and was speaking via Skype with VOA's Victor Beatty. You know, you can always stay on top of the news anytime at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
NASA says that its Kepler mission has found Earth's older and bigger cousin, an exoplanet and star that closely resembles Earth and our Sun. The planet and Sun are part of the Kepler 452 system, which is about 1,400 light years away and located in the constellation Cygnus. The Earth-like exoplanet is located within the star system's habitable zone. That's the area around a star where liquid water could pool on the surface of an orbiting planet. Kepler 452b is also a bit larger than Earth, takes 385 days to orbit its Sun, and is about 5% further from its star than Earth is from the Sun. But since its Sun is 20% brighter and 10% larger than ours, the exoplanet's surface temperature is about the same as ours. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
And this is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. You know, 50 years have passed since Bob Dylan played the music that shocked the audiences at the Newport Folk Festival by plugging in his guitar and embracing that new wave of electric sound. Well, the reverberations of his guitar define popular music as we know it today. And now, VOA's Eric Felton plugs us into that early time.
Then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. Oh, the times, they are a-changing.
In the mid-1960s, the times, they were indeed a-changing. One of the places those changes were being felt was the world of folk music, says rock historian Elijah Wald, author of a new book, Dylan Goes Electric.
There was a moment in the early 60s where you could look at the Billboard charts and 7 of the top 10 albums were folk records. And, you know, Joan Baez, Peter, Paul and Mary, the Kingston Trio, all had huge, huge, huge number one records.
If I had a hammer, I'd a hammer in the morning, I'd a hammer in the evening.
And then all that changed.
In 1964, the Beatles had hit. By 1965, by the summer of 1965, a lot of people in the folk scene were sort of feeling like their world was threatened.
They were hoping that Bob Dylan would come to the rescue. Dylan had become a legend in folk music circles, both as a powerful songwriter and a distinctive singer. Most of the crowd at the Newport Folk Festival on the evening of July 25, 1965, we're expecting to hear this.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Instead, when Dylan took the stage, this is what they got. Bob Dylan had gone electric, and the folk purists didn't like it one bit. But
Dylan had always liked rock and roll, and Dylan didn't think of rock and roll as stupid music.
In fact, Dylan was a Beatles fan. He would later say that from the first time he heard the Beatles, he knew they were pointing to the direction where music had to go.
Honestly, once the Beatles hit, I think that the writing was on the wall, but when Dylan went with the Beatles on that one, that was that. That was essentially the end of the folk scene as a huge mainstream pop trend.
Beyond the music, Dylan's performance that night also marked a turning point in American culture.
before 1965 was really a different world. And it's the 60s of the civil rights movement and of folk music and of joining arms across the generations and across the races. And after 1965, it's the world of rock. And obviously, I'm not saying Dylan created that change, but I do think that the confrontation at Newport happened because it was symbolic of that much larger confrontation and has been remembered because it really is sort of the moment of rupture where the new 60s emerged.
For VOA News, I'm Eric Felton.
And I was just a kid when all that happened, but I have to say, when I heard Dylan shift that way, you know who I thought of? Chuck Berry. What about you guys, huh? Little like Chuck, wasn't it? Oh, yeah. How about that? Here's some names for you. Jillian Welch, Dawes, Robin Hitchcock, others closed out the festival in Newport on the stage on Sunday, along with Al Cooper, who performed in 1965 with Dylan on that stage, and others were there. David Rawlings, the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, Hozier, just a bunch of guys. In fact, the guitar that Dylan used that night in 1965, July the 25th, is owned by the man who owns the Indianapolis Colts. He played $1 million for it back in 2013 and loaned it for the occasion there on Sunday. And organizers say that they invited Dylan to the event. He didn't respond. How about that? Crazy. Well, everybody, thanks for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It was very good to have you with us. Don't forget the world news straight ahead for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon. I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
ISIL is traumatizing a whole generation of Iraqi and Syrian children by subjecting them to violence and slavery. Many of these children have witnessed unimaginable violence, seen loved ones killed and homes destroyed. As a result, many are showing signs of severe trauma and depression that they will carry with them for many years to come. ISIL, also known as Daesh, has kidnapped nearly 500 children to be used as suicide bombers and child soldiers, and it has threatened families, forcing them to give up their boys to fight with Daesh. In 2015 alone, Daesh has trained more than 400 children in Syria, calling them cubs of the caliphate. Children receive intense military and religious training during which they are forced to perform brutal acts and brainwashed to eliminate empathy for ISIL's victims. Currently, some 600 children younger than age 13 are patrolling the streets of Mosul, the second largest city of Iraq. Several months ago, at the Palmyra Roman Amphitheater in Syria, Daesh forced innocent children to brutally slaughter a group of Syrian regime soldiers in front of an audience and produced a video of the execution. Daesh directs much of its propaganda at mothers, instructing them to raise their sons and daughters in the fold of Islamic extremism. A guidebook published by Daesh praises female Islamic fighters as a way to encourage girls to fight. It prints bedtime stories about martyrdom and heroic jihadists. It also encourages children to watch violent videos of Islamic State battles and beheadings in an effort to desensitize them. But most of the Arab world is not deceived by Daesh and openly abhors what it stands for. As a recent parody of a Daesh slogan in Arabic makes clear, "My dear Muslim brothers and sisters, do you know to whom the word Daesh refers? To everyone who kills, rapes, dishonors women, steals money, displaces people, recruits child soldiers, and commits ethnic and religious cleansing. The brutality of Daesh toward children, women, Christians, Yazidis, and Shia must be stopped."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.